backtrack a little. You were born September 20th, 1899, correct?
Right, right.
In Los Angeles?
Los Angeles.
But you grew up here in the peninsula?
Yeah, that's right. I was 1 year old when we moved here.
Oh, I see. Where were your parents from?
My parents were from Germany.
Oh, okay. So you were a first-generation American.
Yeah, they were both in Germany and came out here.
Did they speak English?
They're broken. Broken English.
Now, when you were a child growing up, was baseball your sport? Or did you play other activities?
Well, I played rugby. Of course, they didn't play American football in those days. They just rugby. And they used to fill the stadium with it. It's too bad they don't play it now, because it's a brutal game now. It's brutal. But when I went to Palo High School, I never saw an American football game. Of course, there was no TV or anything in those days.
Sure, sure. So when you were playing baseball as a youngster growing up here in Palo Alto, what sort of equipment did you have? Did you just get together and play on any open lot, or were there facilities?
Yeah, when we started, I think we played, didn't even have a baseball. It was just a bunch of yarn or something, taped, and play out in an open field. I mean, that was 7, 8, 9 years old. I was always crazy about baseball.
Uh-huh.
Always crazy about
it. Did your parents, as immigrants, understand the game of baseball at all?
No, I think my mother went to one game, but she didn't know what it was all about.
And what sort of kids did you play with here in the peninsula? Were there other immigrant children at all? Or
No, there were mostly very few immigrants at that time. But in grammar school, there were so few people going to school in those days. Like my graduating class had 11. So everybody was on the team for there. Whether you're any good or not.
And I take it early on you showed a special ability for the sport, is that correct? Do you have a particular talent for baseball early on?
Well, as I say, I started as an infielder and then went to pitching and stayed there. I guess the thing that kept me going is I had a pretty good curveball.
Oh.
I was wild. I was wild as a dickens. But I was lucky. If I had a small catcher, I was always afraid to throw it over his head and so forth.
Were there other teams when you were growing up here in the peninsula? Did you watch other ball players at all? Study other players?
Well, of course, the Coast League was the big thing, not the big league. The Coast League, was
right?
The big
Pacific Coast League.
Because when I was going to grammar school, all the publicity in the paper was about the San Francisco team, the Oakland team.
The Seals and the Oaks.
Yeah, Seals and the Oaks. Those two. And very little time spent on the big leagues except when somebody was sold to them. Then they had some publicity.
Now, you had noticed, you had mentioned you were playing in high school, and you were noticed by someone with the San Jose franchise.
Yeah,
was
yeah.
It a scout? Or?
Yeah, one day I was... One day I went to Sunnyvale to see a game. I think it was Thanksgiving Day. And on the ninth inning, the score is tied. And the pitcher gets hit to the head with a pitch ball. And he's out. So they asked for volunteers out of the stands. I volunteered. My Sunday clothes. After the game, that's when the San Jose band came up to me. Says, "How'd you like to pitch for San Jose?" I was flattered, you know. And I said, "Sure, sure."
And what year was this?
That was, I would say that was about 1916 or 17.
Were there any notable players on the San Jose team?
No, but eventually our pitching game against Edward Jeff Ritchie down there. He was at Camp Fremont.
Oh, I see.
There was 50,000 people here at Camp Fremont, soldiers. And I remember that we had a game there, but I don't remember any real stars.
And so how long were you with the San Jose club?
Oh, I was there about two years.
And then you mentioned you went to St. Mary's.
Well, I went to St. Mary's, and then from then on I went down to Colingo. Shell Oil had a team.
Oh, I see.
And I played for them for a couple of years.
Now, while you were at St. Mary's, what years did you attend?
I was there in 20 and 21.
Do you remember who the manager was? The manager of the St. Mary's ball club?
The first year was Speed Martin. Used to be with the Cubs.
Yeah.
He was an Oakland boy. And the next year we had Louis Gisto and Walter Mayles. We had two coaches.
Yeah, of course, St. Mary's had a terrific baseball tradition, didn't
they? Yeah, they did. They did those days, yes. And actually the competition wasn't too tough, though.
What sort of schools did you play? What different schools did you play?
St. Mary's the only one.
Uh-huh. And what schools did St. Mary's play?
Well, in those days, we played California and Stanford. And they were at odds with Santa Clara, so there was no rivalry there. No proper relations or something.
Now, Hal Chase has gone to Santa Clara, correct?
Chase, yeah, down there, yeah.
And at St. Mary's, was the team at that time known as the Phoenix Ball Club?
Yeah, they called the Phoenix, yes.
And St. Mary's at that point was in Oakland?
It was in Oakland, yes, on Broadway there.
Well, there were several ball players from the St. Mary's team, very notable ones, like Duffy Lewis.
Yeah, that was long before my time. Lewis and Hooper were both went to Boston. Played the outfield for Boston. Of course, Walter Mayles, I think he was Santa Clara.
Well, he had gone to St. Mary's, I believe.
Yeah.
Along with Stubby Mack, Lou Guisto.
Stubby and I played together.
Oh, he did?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, Stubby and I were together.
Any memories of Stubby on the St. team?
Stubby didn't believe in rules. Finally, Joe Devine sold him to Seattle. And from Seattle, he went to Washington.
Right. Let's see, there were a couple other ball players on St. Mary's during that time. There was Ed Burns, a catcher.
I never saw Ed Burns.
Joe Ossinger, pitcher?
Joe Oscar. Right. Yeah, he's from Ferndale up there somewhere. In fact, one time I happened to bump into Joe on the train at Chicago, and we rode from Chicago to San Francisco, and at that time I asked Joe, I said, what's the difference between pitching in the big leagues and the coast leagues? What's the difference? He said, well, in the big leagues you probably get 7 pretty good hitters. Coast League, you got 5. And he said, that's the only difference. And of course, the other, you get better support. In the big league, better support.
And he had pitched with the Boston Braves?
He pitched with the Braves, yeah.
Whether he
went to somebody else later, I don't know. But he was in that 26 inning game.
And he pitched the entire game,
yeah.
Though, right?
Yeah.
Did you ever have an opportunity to talk to him about that experience?
No, I don't remember. I probably did, but I don't remember the conversation.
Another St. Mary's graduate was Lou Fonseca. Do you recall him?
Oh, Louis?
Yes.
I didn't know he went to St. Mary's.
Apparently he went for 1 or 2 years.
I'll get you a picture of Louis.
Okay. So if we were to pick up your story, after you left St. Mary's in the early 20s, were you scouted?
21.
Okay. Were you
21, yeah.
Were you scouted by a major league scout?
Well, I could have signed with several major league with Calgary, maybe 2 months before school was out, with Joe Devine. And other people would give me contracts, and I couldn't sign it because I already signed one.
And Calgary was in which league?
Western Canadian League. It was Calgary, Edmonton, Winnipeg, Moose Jaw, Saskatoon, Regina. Those six clubs.
And this was what, in 1921?
That was 1921, yeah. And then I was sold to Cincinnati during that year.
And now I can imagine playing in Calgary might have been pretty cold.
Well, that's how I hurt my arm at Winnipeg. In those days, you received no medical attention. If you had a sore arm, that was your problem. You had to go to a osteopath or a chiropractor. And I guess I went to, without exaggerating, I went to 100 different ones. Now, I know two give you the same treatment. Some would dig in and some would really work on your back and some would be massaged. So I know along the way some of them did more harm than good.
Now, you had mentioned as growing up you were an infielder primarily.
Yeah.
At Calgary, did you develop into a pitcher full-time?
Oh, no. Yeah, I was a full-time pitcher in Calgary. In fact, I was a pitcher in Palo Alto High School the last year I was there. I was a pitcher then.
And your curveball had improved, right?
Curveball was my main factor.
What else did you have in your repertoire of pitches?
Well, I was wild. I would walk as many men as I would strike out. Pete Donahue was, and I married sisters.
Oh, really?
And
Pete Donahue went to Texas Christian University.
Yeah. Now, Pete Donahue, in my estimation, had the best control of any pitcher in the entire world.
Really?
And he didn't have the curveball. He would get me on the side, with a curve. Every ball he threw was like that. Screwball. Every ball, even when he threw from the pitcher to first base. You're a screwball. But that's the way his hand went all the time. He never did it that way. Never did it that way.
Not unlike Carl Hubbell, who had a very unique delivery.
Probably. But he wanted the worst way to be able to throw a curve, and he couldn't do it.
I've heard Pete Donahue had a very effective changeup.
He did. He had a great changeup and a great screwball.
In fact, I read somewhere that he's credited with perfecting the changeup. Would that be accurate to say?
What's this fellow used to write that cartoon, Believe It or Not?
Ripley's.
Yeah, Ripley. Had him on there. He went 56 innings without walking a man. Oh. And one day, this is funny. One day I relieved him in Pittsburgh, in the fifth inning. I pitched the last, from the fifth on. And he took his shower, and he went and dressed. And he sat behind the catcher to see how I was getting along there. And he said, remember so-and-so, I think it was Max Carey. Remember Max Carey? You had two balls and one strike? And I said, yeah. Then he got a base hit. He said, you made a mistake there. I said, well, how did I make the mistake? He said, but two balls and one strike, never throw a strike. I said, God, if he takes it, it's 3-1. Look at the, he's got me. And He says, no, you're still even with him. He has such good control that he could even waste the pitch with two balls to one strike.
Remarkable.
Yeah. And you know, we go to a circus, and there'd be a fellow out there hit something and get a teddy bear or something like that. Well, he missed the first one on purpose. And then he talked the fellow into, he said, oh, I'm able to hit that. You know, the fellow wouldn't know who he was. He would just, all of a sudden, he would hit 10 in a row. And they'd kick him out. You know, beat it. Get it out of here. He'd give the teddy bears to kids around there.
Terrific. Now, we're talking about your days in Calgary. Did you play with any future major leaguers in the Canadian
League? Oh, God, yeah. There's a lot of them. Edmonton had Heine Manouche and Babe Herman. But they didn't figure in. We won the pennant that year, won the playoff and everything. But we didn't even have a 300 hitter. And they had all kinds of 300 hits. Those are the two there. Regina had Jimmy Sprager. Moose Jaw had Mark Kenig. Winnipeg had a couple of guys. A fellow named Grabowski. I think he was a catcher for the Yankees for a while. Oscar Melillo, he was second baseman for St. Louis for a long time. The fellows, Kaufman and I, were the leading pitchers all the time up there. Kaufman from Winnipeg and myself from Calgary, and they'd always pitch us against each other. They advertised that they were going to pitch the two of us against each other. So I guess I pitched against him six times. And probably he beat me three times and I beat him three times or something. Otherwise we'd both have better averages.
Well now, Canada of course has two major league franchises. Was baseball popular in Canada during this period?
Well, not as popular as hockey. Hockey would outdraw them 2-1. So I think the biggest crowd we ever had up there was 4,000. And but usually it was I think maybe 300 or 400 or 500 something like that.
Now returning to the subject of your parents again, they were immigrants from Germany. What did they think of your choice to become a professional baseball player?
Well, I don't know whether they liked it or not. I don't know whether they liked it or not. They didn't say anything, but I don't know whether they liked it. They didn't understand that it was a paying proposition.
Speaking of which, how much were you paid when you played with Calgary?
Calgary, I think I was getting $275. But of course, you only had a short season, so you didn't end up the year with very much money. And I think, of course, with the Reds. If I remember right, I thought I was overpaid, getting $5,000 a year.
Now, what were the playing conditions like in the minor leagues in Calgary?
Calgary? Well, there's no fences there. Probably if you hit a homer, you had to hit one that took a bad bounce over somebody's head or something like that. But they played twilight ball there. It started, I think, at 6:30. Because at that particular time, it didn't get dark until 11 o'clock or so. And then daylight again at 2:30 or 3 o'clock.
What were the playing conditions like?
Well, of course, you only had the one umpire. And the conditions are okay. In those days, none of the parts were extra good, except they were big. In fact, that's how Donahue was so effective. He would have him hit long foul flies, pitch inside.
Well, Redlands Field was huge. The right field fence was 400 feet from home plate.
And you could catch foul balls on the outfield. You could catch foul balls in the catcher. The backstop was, I guess, 100 feet in the back. So the catcher had all that room. And I know first baseman and the third baseman caught a lot of fly balls.
Now, back again to Calgary, what was the travel like? When you went to Winnipeg?
That was a miserable trip because it took a day and a half to get there. Day and a half. And all you see is wheat fields along the way.
And this was by bus?
No, train.
Train?
No, we had no bus travel up there at all. Everything was train. Edmonton was a... most of the, like, 8 hours to get to Edmonton.
And who was your manager at Calgary?
Joe Devine.
Right.
Joe Devine. And you had just one manager, and then you had a kind of an assistant there, a fellow named Pat Kilfula. He's Oakland boy. He was second in command.
So there was no pitching coach?
No, goodness. In fact, there was no pitching coach in the big leagues.
You were just left on your own.
You know, in the big leagues, you had Pat Moran as the manager of Cincinnati. That's all there was. There was nothing else. Now, we didn't even have a trainer at Cincinnati. You had the trainer, he had the title trainer. They call him Doc. But, he had his big job was to get our uniforms and gloves and everything from one city to the next city. That was his big job. So there was no trainer. And now I see when they announce various clubs, they have maybe three trainers and so forth.
Now, speaking of gloves, what sort of equipment did you have? What sort of ball glove did you have?
I had a Bill Bolt glove, which I would say half the people used. Bill Bolt glove. It was a very good glove. I liked it myself.
So we moved to the year 1922, and you're finally called up to the majors, correct?
22, yes. I was sold in 21. I was sold in 21, but reported in 22.
And did anyone in particular inform you that you were going to Cincinnati? Did you speak to anyone from the Cincinnati Ball Club?
Well, the one that helped me the most, I think, was Sammy Bowman. And Sammy came to me, I remember one time, he says, "What's Donahue? Every pitch has a purpose." And I never thought much about that until years later. I said, "By God, Sammy knew what he was talking about." Because when Donahue made a pitch, it was going to be here at a spot there. But when I pitched, I just threw. And that should take its course.
Now, did you talk to the owner of the ranch, Mr. Herman, at all?
I never saw Mr. Herman. He was, there was something wrong with him. And I don't think anybody saw him.
Now, how did you negotiate your salary with the Cincinnati Ball Club?
Well, I didn't negotiate. I took what they offered me. And I just got a contract, and that was it. I signed it.
Did Pat Moran, the manager, talk to you at all before
No, Pat didn't I don't think I ever, well, I had maybe a conversation now and then with Pat, but I don't recall what he said or anything.
Did you report to the Cincinnati spring training in Mineral Springs, Texas?
The Mineral Springs or Mineral Wells? What is it?
I believe it was Mineral Springs, Texas.
Yeah, well, of course, that was kind of a health resort, you know. Everything was called crazy. Like, we stayed at the crazy hotel, we drank their crazy water. In fact, you can still buy their crazy pellets at the drugstore from there. And everything in town was called crazy. Then the next year, we traded to
Orlando.
Yeah.
What was it like for a rookie to show up in a Major League spring training?
It was okay. Of course, the old-timers associated with themselves, and the rookies sort of with themselves. I mean, you look like, you know, I remember Jake Dorbert coming, reporting to spring training, and he mingled with all the rookies, and finally he said, have your boys eaten yet? I'm going to the dining room. I mean, he wanted to eat with us.
And he must have been about 35 years old at the time?
Jake was, yeah. Yeah, Jake was established. He was established.
He was a terrific first baseman.
Yeah, he was. Yeah, I liked Jake.
And when you reported to the team, was there still the feeling of the Black Sox scandal that had happened in 1919?
No, nothing was mentioned about it. Nothing was mentioned about it. The only Black Sox I played against in the bushes. I was playing for Shell Oil at Oil Fields, and we played Bakersfield. Gandil was playing first base for Bakersfield.
So he was in the Industrial League in California?
Well, that wasn't the league. That wasn't the league. That was just a team that the towns had, like they had Bakersfield, they had Lemoore, Hanford, Dinuba, Visalia, but there was no league there, but we just played against each other.
And most of the teams were represented by a company, right?
Well, like Shell Oil, was the oil fields, yeah.
What about for Bakersfield? Chick Gamble's team, were they?
Yeah, I don't remember now who operated that. I think it was some hotel.
Were there any other major leaguers in the claim of those teams that you had mentioned?
Well, yes, my memory is kind of shot here.
Well, this did happen some 70 years ago.
Yeah, but some pitcher that used to be with the Seals did a good job there, then he went to the Chicago White Sox. But I forget his name. Of course, there was a lot of old ex-Coast Leaguers there. Carlisle, Haas, they were Los Angeles, Cy Falkenberg. Now he was, Cy was a real every ball pitcher. I remember one time, Cy was playing for Lemoore, and I was playing for Hanford then. The ball would come in, such a, would take a real hop. We don't know how he did, but the batter asked, I want to see the ball. And he took a look and he couldn't find out anything on it. He threw it over the backstop, of course they kicked him out of the game. But I understand later that all Falkenberg did was to take the seams of the baseball and rough in the seams up. And that gave a terrific every ball.
It's significant you should mention it because, of course, in 1920, Judge Landis had outlawed a lot of those pitches,
but the ones that use it could still use it.
And right, so, like Burley Grind.
Burley Grind was the best of the bunch, yes. But St. Louis had, Bill Doak was on him. St. Louis had about three spitball pitchers. But I would rather pitch against a spitball pitcher than anybody else.
Then why is that?
The spit would shrink the cover, and the seams would stick out as rough as a dickens. And when you throw your curveball, you're holding a big rough seam there and a big rough seam there. And you'd have a brand new ball was my weakness, because you couldn't curve it either. Unless you had a big head or something.
Of course, back in that era, they used the same ball.
That was another big difference too. They threw the ball back from the stands out to the plane with it, so you didn't use many brand new balls. In fact, I remember one time there was only two balls left in the game. One was a brand new one, one was an old one, and every time they would throw me the new one, I would throw it back to the catcher, and he'd throw me the old one. And they objected to that. They said, he's only doing that because the ball's okay. But he's only doing that because he wants to get a curveball.
I bet that ball got pretty dark as the innings went on.
Someone named Fairbanks, a pitcher for Edmonton. When he pitched, that ball was black. Pure black.
Must have been difficult to hit. Now, of course, by 1922, the Red Leg team had gone through a lot of changes. Gone were Heidi Groh.
Yeah, they got rid of him.
Todd Eller was gone.
Yeah, he was. I don't know when they let him go. I never saw Todd Eller.
And so there was a lot of fresh new talent.
You had John Scott and Burns at the outfield.
Right, right. Now, what about Babe Piniella? He came from the Bay Area.
That was the same year Babe came up.
Right. He came from the Oakland Oaks.
Yeah. You know, I was standing right next to Babe when they announced the next hitter, Babe Piniella. The whole stand scooted. Not because they were mad at Piniella, because they traded Heidi Groh. And I remember old Babe said, I'm going to change that before the season's over. So he had a lot of guts. Babe had a lot of guts.
Of course, Babe went in to fill third base, the third base spot.
Yeah.
It had been left open when Heidi Groh was traded.
Well, you know, up in Calgary, they would bunt. I'd have to go up and get it. And I remember up in the first game I pitched up there, or near the first game, they bunted. Apparently it was there, made the play. Ordinarily, I would, like Calgary, I would have to make the play. And but he was the type of guy that was always in front of the ball. Might hit him in the belly, but he'd get the guy on first base.
He's a tough ball player.
Oh, God, yeah.
I assume he took some of those qualities when he later became a very famous umpire.
Yeah, that was before the umpire. I think he umpired that perfect game.
And he did.
I think so, yes.
Yeah, the Don Larson perfect game. Yeah. In fact, that was the last game that he had umpired.
It was?
Yes. Yeah.
I didn't know that. I didn't know that.
Did you speak to Babe in his later years at all?
No, not after Cincinnati, no. No. Babe was... one time, Babe was afflicted with an ailment that you walk in the wrong direction and so forth.
Huh.
I forget what they call it. Kind of a like people would tell me they would want to get his autograph. I never could get him.
He would walk in the opposite direction.
Because they always have some excuse.
Now, let's talk about some of the other teammates on the Cincinnati team. There was Jimmy Cavani.
Yeah.
A shortstop from the San Francisco Seals.
Yeah.
Another Bay Area ball player.
Yeah, he's in that picture.
Now, what was he like?
Well, Jimmy was kind of a devil-may-care. Like I remember one time he, something happened to one of his fingers. So he just tapes it up and keeps on playing. Of course, no medical attention, so.
Right. Of course, in those days, if a ball player were to get injured, he might very well lose his job.
Yeah, right. They'd have to take care of himself. They did have a club doctor, but I don't think anybody ever went to him.
Now, you had an outfielder on that team from Oklahoma City by the name of George Harper.
Oh, yeah, George. Yeah, Weezy Neal used to play right field. And he was having a bad year. And I remember he went to Moran and he said, "Pat, take me out of there. Put in Harper." And Harper went in and never got out again. He got the job.
Now also in that outfield you had Pat Duncan?
Yeah, left fielder. Yeah, he was more of a hitter than anything else. He wasn't too good at outfielder, but he hit good.
Of course, your outfield that year in 1922 suffered a bit because Eddie Rausch sat out.
He didn't report until the 4th of July.
And that was over a contract dispute?
Over a contract, yeah. So if he had reported the first of the year, Cincinnati would have won the pennant. Because I think we were 5 games behind the Giants. We finished in second place. And if Eddie had reported at the first game, he would have been the difference. He was great. He was great.
Yeah, he's credited as being one of the greatest hitters of the dead ball era, certainly.
Yeah. You know, he never put the hit and run on unless he was in the hole. Like, he would put the hit and run on with 2 strikes and no balls. Now, that's hard to believe. And he says, why put it on when they expect it? That was his theory.
Now, Eddie Rausch would call his own hit and run?
Oh, yes. In fact, in those days, some of the players used their own judgment. Of course, you didn't have the coaches. You had no, when they wanted the coach, it'd be one of the players.
Now, how would the batter then signal to the base runner that a hit and run was
they'd,
on?
They'd have their own signals to the base runner. Rausch would tell so-and-so what was going to happen.
Do you think there were any particular advantages to that method as opposed to having a base coach call the...
Personally, I like it better. I like it better. I don't like to see a catcher have to look at the manager now to find out what the throw is. God, I'd hate that. I'd like to use my own judgment on that. Right. Or the catcher's judgment.
Right. Now, you had mentioned that Cincinnati could have very well won the pennant in 1922 had Eddie Rausch showed up in spring training and played the entire year. Did the teammates resent him?
No. They welcomed him with open arms when he reported.
So they felt that his behavior was justified?
Oh, yeah. There was no publicity about it at all. I don't know. I mean, there were no dollars mentioned or anything. So we don't know. I don't know what he was holding on for. No, nobody knew. It was all secrets. It isn't like it is today, where everybody knows what everybody else is making.
Right. Now, you mentioned that you had a good friend on the team who was another Pacific Coast League product, Sammy Bond.
Oh, Sammy, yeah, Sammy was great. Sammy was great. He offered to help me quite a bit.
And he played second base, shortstop?
Yeah. Well, second base mostly, yeah. Mostly.
And you were friends with him off the field?
Well, we didn't stay at the same hotel in Cincinnati. I would go on a, Sammy would go on a, in New York, he would go to a wholesale house. Because later, I think Sammy was in the, some kind of a suit, clothing business. But I think they call it Bone of California, but I'm not sure. But Sammy gave me the nickname of Jug Handle.
Jug Handle?
Yeah. On account of my curveball.
Oh, I see.
And because I did have the biggest curve on the six out of team.
Did anyone compliment you on your curveball at all, opposing ball players at all? Or?
I remember when Pat Moran introduced me to Jim Corbett. He says, Jim, here's a fellow that has a curveball and I like your brother, Joe. Now, Joe Corbett used to be a baseball player. Jim Corbett's brother. He played for Philadelphia. And I had that reputation as a curveball. In fact, one time we up in Calgary, when they knew I was going to pitch against them that day, they had the pitcher throw curveballs in batting practice, which I never saw before or since. And so Pat Kilholman, the catcher, says, look, they're throwing curveballs in batting practice. So I tell you what we're going to do. I tell you what we're going to do now. The first ball we throw every batter is going to be a curveball. From then on, fastballs. Fastballs. And it kind of caught them off guard. They were looking for the curve all the time. Looking for the curve.
Did you have another pitch at all, besides the fastball and curve?
No, I didn't. Of course, I had different kinds of curves. You had the out, you had the straight down and all that stuff. So, of course, the straight down curve is a kind of a loop, you know, but the other curve is a kind of a break.
Now, again, that story you told me about Pat Moran gathering up all the San Francisco ball players to meet the great boxer, Jim Corbett.
Yeah.
Were your teammates excited about meeting him?
Well, of course, we didn't know who we were going to meet until we saw him. And, of course, we were pleased that he came over. Because evidently he lived in Chicago at that time. Evidently. I don't know. Of course, he had been retired for some time. He had been retired. He used to be a bank clerk in San Francisco, you know.
Do you recall what you talked about with him?
No, I don't, except that after the introductions, it was just a matter of leaving for dinner afterwards.
Now, did the ball players on the Cincinnati club from the Bay Area, would they hang out with one another? Did they, were they friends?
Well, of course, I lived in the same hotel as Johnny Gillespie, because we were in Calgary together. We were sold together to Cincinnati. And he did better than I did back there, but I did better in Calgary. I led the league in Calgary, 21-6. And Kaufman with Winnipeg won 23 and lost 7. So I was just a few points ahead of him. But Johnny didn't have a good year at Calgary. I think it was 14-9 or something. So, but when he went to Cincinnati, he did pretty good.
And he was your roommate?
He was my roommate, yeah.
Okay. Now, what about second baseman Lou Fonseca?
Who?
Lou Fonseca.
Oh, Fonseca. Well, he was, Lou was a kind of a utility man and pinch hitter. But he would play second once in a while. Robert was unable to play, he played first. But I think when he was sold to Cleveland, I think they put him on third base. No, Lou wasn't fast. He was kind of a big man. But he was a good hitter. Lou was a good hitter. I think he's still alive.